The Red Eye Radio Podcast is a service of Freightliner and Detroit.
Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or you're just starting your day, welcome to the show. This is Red Eye Radio.
All across America, 866-90-RED-EYE. He is Eric Harley and I'm Gary McNamara. Good morning.
Hello.
It was a good day yesterday on social media just because it was National Radio Day. So it seems like all the radio people I ever worked with were communicating with each other, you know, sending pictures back and forth from all the different radio stations that I've worked for and they've worked for. And it's been a great week because in this week of, you know, National Radio Day, but in the prior week, I actually reconnected with somebody who I worked with 33 years ago in the small market of Marshall, Texas. And it was great.
Yeah.
And I don't, she's a justice of the peace.
Yeah.
And it's just like, wow. I mean, she's a great personality that I work with. And just late yesterday afternoon, I reconnected with the person who forced me to do talk radio.
Yeah. Who was that?
Sue Myers.
Okay.
And I have not talked to her. You know, you move on. People are just busy and you lose phone numbers and we hadn't communicated in over 20 years. And I was talking with, you know, going back and forth on social media from some of the people of that radio station that I worked at in Niagara Falls, New York. And all of a sudden she appeared. And I didn't, you know, she's using her maiden name. And so I didn't even know what her maiden name was. And so I didn't even know she was using it. So I hadn't been able to find her in years. And all of a sudden she appeared and, you know, said something. I was sarcastic back, but we reconnected. And she is the one that I was working at a small AM station. This is back in 1989 and making that transition from a music station to a talk station. And we couldn't find a talk show host we liked for the one talk show that we had. And one day she said to me, "You're going to do it." And I said, "I can't and I won't." And she said, "You don't have a choice." And here I am 30 years later. And I hated it for the first probably 2 to 3 years. I hated it. Because it was a lot of work, and it's not what I wanted to do. And because of her, I found what I really love doing.
Good.
And it just shows you, I don't care who you are, you have no idea if you're a young person out there, you have no idea what you might like.
Right.
No idea.
Right.
No idea.
Yeah. Mine was court ordered. And I tried to run away. I cut the ankle bracelet off a few times. That didn't work out. I remember when I first got into radio many moons ago, and yesterday was like the perfect representation, I guess, of where it all began, because there's no such thing as National Radio Day. I don't care what anybody says. Somebody in radio made that up. So, or at Hallmark, or both. And that's fine.
Hallmark, yes.
That's fine. That's fine.
Yes.
It really is so much fun. It's truly really been a blessing in my life. And I think about my early days because I hear so many people say in our profession, "Oh, I grew up and I always wanted to do radio." When I got into it, just out of high school full time, but I was in high school when I first started in radio, I was just looking for a job. And it seemed like a cool thing to do, right? And I got into it and instantly fell in love with it. And then the question, well, but how do I make a living at it? Because it doesn't pay anything. So you go through, like most careers, like a lot of careers, I should say, you go through those moments of going, you know, wow, is this going to last? Is it going to be real? Is it going to be enough? Can I really? And I just kept going to work every day. And so yesterday was an interesting representation because I got a few messages from friends. I wasn't on social media at all yesterday. I haven't been much lately. And but I got, I was getting messages from friends, happy National Radio Day. I was like, yeah, right. Thank you. And, you know, I was like, I didn't, for me, it was just, at the beginning, it was just, hey, this looks like a cool job. I want to, you know, I need work and this looks like a cool job. And I just instantly fell in love with it. But my approach to it still today, and loving it is while I love to look back and so many pictures being shared yesterday, I found out late in the day, well, actually on the way in tonight, of you know, my career or guys and gals that I've worked with that they shared. I just looked at it and said, you know, but I'm still right now still feel like I'm new at this, that I need to learn a lot. And, you know, I mean, our production crew can tell you that. They'll back me up on that. There's still a lot to learn. But it is that effort that I, you know, I feel like I should come in and earn it again every day and all over again, right? And that's what I've tried to do. So it was really great looking back on it. I only had a few minutes last night before the show began to kind of see what everybody was doing because I didn't see it during the day yesterday. But it's neat, but it is a reminder. You and I had a CEO friend that once gave us a saying, and I think it was Kissinger who said it, that each level of success is only the beginning of a new set of challenges. And I'm paraphrasing there. The quote from Henry, Kissinger.
Every new success just brings you a new set of problems.
A new set of challenges, yeah, or problems, right, or whatever it is. But that's kind of the idea, is that you take it on, and we've been, you know, successful here, and we greatly appreciate our audience for making that happen. And it was neat to, you know, again, I'm still in that mindset of you go in, you work for it, you work hard.
Just a couple things. First off, the picture sharing of my old pictures from the 80s, I could have done without.
Yeah, mine too.
Seriously, I was the definition of a dweeb.
Well, and the answer is no, I was never in Metallica. Someone told me you look just like the former and now deceased bassist, the original bassist Cliff,
yes,
from Metallica. You look a lot like him. Yeah, because I had the mustache.
Okay. Oh, long, that's right, the mustache.
Old hair, the old long hair and the mustache photos. And it was like, yeah, but I was, first of all, I was a bass player, but I was never as nearly as talented as he was. Okay, I was pretty talented, but not nearly as talented as he was. And no, I'm not related to him.
Well, the one thing, and I was watching the documentary "I Am Patrick Swayze" that just came on. It was promoted and premiered. I forgot who premiered it. Was it Reels or I can't remember who it was, but it's really, really good. I mean, they have his wife and his brother and everybody, whoever was, you know, had a major role with him in a movie on. And so it was really great. But they talked about it. And you hear this with actors and they talk about the fact that, well, you know, I didn't get this role or I was typecast in this. And I started thinking as you know, and they all look back, you know, what is my legacy? What is the legacy of what I've done? And I thought about all the different media that exist out there. And I've had friends that are still in television today. And really, I think that what we do here is the absolute best. If you're going to be in the media, in the entertainment or media, this is the best. And you know why? Because even if you're in Hollywood, you're playing somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're in, you know, you can be in music radio and you may not necessarily be able to be exactly who you are. In this job in the media, I think is completely and totally unique because you get to be every single day exactly who you are. I mean, that's wonderful.
Right.
And so people say, well, you look back at it. Well, I was me. Well, some people didn't like you. Well, what's the Van Zandt song? I'd rather be hated for who I am than loved for who I'm not. It's that simple.
Right.
So, to me, that's the best thing when you look at all the different things in the media that you could be. You know, even a columnist, you're limited to what that column is for the day. But on a show like ours that, you know, whether, and most radio shows, probably talk radio shows are, you know, 3 to 5 hours, you get to be exactly who you wish to be. You get to talk about whatever you wish to talk about. You get to talk about what was going on during your day. You get to talk about what's going on with everybody else's day. What a wonderful thing to be able to do. I mean, I'm so blessed to be doing this. And I'm so blessed because a lot of the people that I communicated with yesterday on National Radio Day, they've been out for years. You know, radio can be sort of like professional football, where I think the average length of a career is only 3 to 4 years. Most of the people that I went to college with that also had the dream of radio have been out for 10 to 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, they were out in their 40s because they were in music radio and never, you know, made the leap to talk. So I look at it, I'm like, my God, am I blessed? You know, and to be in this media form of radio that was supposed to be dead by now.
Right.
Remember, they were talking 1949, 1950, radio's going to be gone. TV's going to kill it. MTV in the 80s again, video killed the radio star. Not really.
Nope.
And so it was just a great day to be reminiscing with all, you know, the old radio folks out there. And really it made me just, again, appreciative of the privilege and honor that I have that companies have actually hired me. And that's the one thing, because people ask all the time, what's the relationship between you and your company? It's always been, for the most part, of all companies, it's been wonderful. Because in the back of my mind, I just sit and think, they hired me and said, go to that little studio and you have an unlimited audience and say whatever you want. Really? Well, I hate you.
Yeah. What a horrible job.
What a horrible job. I can't believe management told me that. And so when you realize how blessed you are to do this particular, if you want to call it art form, media form, whatever it is, it is completely and totally unique. And so thank you, Sue, again, who I reconnected with yesterday, the owner of the radio station in Niagara Falls, New York, that forced me to do talk radio that I hated for over 2 years and didn't realize it, that it's probably the closest of being a perfect match for what I want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, it really is. And you understand it because we have these talks all the time off the air, you know, just how great it is to come in and just do what we do every day.
Well, because often in your early days, I guess, of media, at least in my case, in other forms of media, other forms of radio, which are great, but it's an entertainment form of radio, and so is this, but it's also information, discussion, and I think it's part of the, you know, a part of, especially with social media now added to the mix, part of the greater discussion in a society, in a free society, mm-hmm. especially. And it has a very important place. When you're in entertainment radio, again, it has its role. But for me, I felt like I wanted something more out of, you know, the back and forth. I wanted to be able to serve an audience, I guess, in a different way. And that was it. So, you know, 22 and a half years ago, I started this thing. Or I began at this thing. So, and a total of what? 35 years in radio coming up September 4th. Yeesh.
37 this year. October, the first week of October will be 30 years in talk radio.
Yeah.
So, because October.
You got me beat.
Just by a couple of years. 37 total. Mm-hmm. See, my banking and, mm-hmm. You know, and steelworker stuff got in the way for a while, a couple of years.
Yeah.
Because I sucked.
At banking?
No.
Oh.
Radio when I first got in. I know. I still suck today. I understand. It's, but just so everyone knows, and I think I can speak for Eric here, we never take this for granted. Ever.
No.
I mean, it's just every day we come in, it's like, wow, can you believe we do this?
Yeah, it really is. It's a great opportunity, and we're very grateful.
866-90-RUD-EYE.
In 2018, 14% of the commercial vehicles inspected during CVSA's Brake Safety Week were placed out of service for brake-related violations. This year, the Brake Safety Initiative is set for the week of September 15th. Keep your brake system in top shape and avoid being placed out of service with the following maintenance tip. Conduct effective visual inspections frequently, keeping an eye out for problems such as loose hoses and leaks. Check foundation drum brakes for lining cracks, oil-saturated linings, or broken cam brackets. If your vehicle is equipped with air disc brakes, check the rotors for cracks or grooving, and make sure the caliper is sliding freely. Stop in to a TA Truck Service Center near you to have your brake system serviced by a professional technician ahead of this year's Brake Safety Week.
This maintenance tip is brought to you by TA Truck Service. More bays, more expertise, more solutions.
We'll be right back with more Red Eye Radio with Eric Harley and Gary McNamara.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. Coming up following the bottom of the hour, some thought, because now the questions, now that the whole Russian collusion thing has moved away from Trump, now the question's actually being asked. What did Obama know, and when did Obama know it? And a great point was made last night on Fox News by Andrew McCarthy, who has written the book that I'm reading right now, Ball of Collusion. Sean Hannity was, you know, saying, well, Obama had to know. And he said, well, wait a minute. He said, well, here's the point. If it's a counterintelligence investigation, that means you do a counterintelligence investigation for the president to let the president know what's going on. So the counterintelligence investigation was being done on Trump and the campaign, to the point of trying to get a FISA warrant. If you're getting a FISA warrant and you're part of the FBI, you're the FBI, the head of the FBI and the Department of Justice, and you're getting a FISA warrant just 10 days before an election, if you don't tell the president of the United States what you're doing, that's dereliction of duty.
Right.
What a great point.
Wow.
And so we'll actually hear that coming up. Plus, AOC calls the Electoral College a scam, says it has a racial injustice breakdown, really just when you can tear her arguments just apart. So she's too easy.
Yeah.
Let me make this.
Yeah.
She's too easy to break down her argument.
Okay, yes. Finish the sentence there.
Finish the sentence.
Yeah. Too easy to defeat in a debate of this nature. Saying she's too easy, yes, and leaving it at that is could be misconstrued as something else.
I don't
and
have
there
to...
is no reason to believe anything else.
I'm telling you, I do not have to lower myself to make that kind of statement in order to win the argument.
Right. We do. We only do that off the air. So, happy National Radio Day. So, you won't be hearing that ever.
Oh.
Yeah, no. It is the breakdown of that is very simple. So,
well,
it always is.
What we'll show you is the fact of how she really wishes to change the entire concept of the country.
Yeah.
Right. Because if you want to be a successful socialist, you have to.
A sex socialist.
Did I say a sex socialist? Boy, I'm just.
Yeah.
You wish to be a sex socialist. Yeah. I have no idea what that means.
Yeah. Happy National Radio Day.
I think I've talked myself out. Do we have a break coming up here? Can I take a break for a couple of moments and then regain my thoughts and then come back here before I get myself in deep? Before this is my last day in radio.
I think Brian's hesitating to kind of leave the line out there for you a little bit. Yeah, okay. All right, he's giving you the break here.
This probably would not be my time to lose my job, you know, on this
day. Yeah, let's not do that.
No.
Debate is a science. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley, trained professionals. Red Eye Radio.
Okay.
And he's Eric Harley. I'm Gary McNamara. Welcome and good morning. All right, so you ready? I'm going to play this little audio cut from Andrew McCarthy on Fox News last night. And the reason this is important is now that his book is out and now that the Mueller investigation is over, everything turns. And this is something the mainstream media is not going to be covering. But the question is now coming up. With everything that was going on, what did Obama know?
Mm.
And Andrew McCarthy makes this great point about the fact that if, remember, they got the first, they tried to get the first FISA warrant, as you remember, in July, and it was refused, right? Mm-hmm. Then they went back again with the dossier and what other material they have. We know they had the dossier, and they got the FISA warrant.
Right.
Well, when they got that first FISA warrant, who was president of the United States?
Mm.
Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that time, we know that a counterintelligence investigation is used by the FBI to give that information specifically to the president. That's what a counterintelligence investigation is about. That's what you do as the FBI. We're doing a counterintelligence investigation. And our goal is to do counterintelligence, find out what's going on in order to tell the president of the United States for national security reasons. So they had this investigation going on of Trump. And then they get a FISA warrant, a secret warrant on one of his campaign managers one of his campaign workers based on the premise that Trump is colluding with the Russians in order, because the first FISA warrant was before, in order to hack the election. And here is the point that Andrew McCarthy makes last night.
Sean, if things were working properly, the president should have been alerted about it and informed about it. It was a very important investigation. If they actually believed what they were telling the court, that it was a possibility that Donald Trump was actually a plant of the Kremlin, it would have been derelict on their part not to keep the president informed.
What else do you have to say?
Wow.
Sometimes the most obvious things are sitting right there, and
something that I don't know anyone that's made that point before. Because we talked about notifying the candidate, right? That
yes,
someone in his being Trump, that somebody in his organization, you know, Carter Page, or somebody else could have been working with the Russians. Why wouldn't you go to Trump? A sitting president was not told, not briefed.
Now, we know because, remember Susan Rice, who wrote that letter right 15 minutes before she left on Inauguration Day, that, you know, remember, wrote that email, and this was, we talked about this a long time ago, wrote mm-hmm. the email mm-hmm. where they were all in a meeting together, and the president said, you must follow the rules, you must follow the rules, you must follow the rules. And it was one of the last emails minutes before she ended her term that was written. And everybody's questioned, and they questioned it last night, why was that written? Was that written in order to deflect any blame off the president? Because the whole point was they were sitting in on the meeting and talking to the president about what was going on with the investigation of the Trump campaign.
Yeah, were they giving him, the president, plausible deniability?
Exactly. And so that would have been early January when that was going on, where they were briefing the but was that the first briefing? And that's the point that's being brought up. Well, wait a minute, if you're doing a counterintelligence investigation and you believe that the person that is running for president of the United States is colluding with the Kremlin in order to steal an election, and you're getting a secret warrant just a couple of weeks before the election is held to find out if one of his campaign workers can give you information, and your whole premise to the FISA court is that you believe their campaign is working with the Kremlin to steal the election, And a counterintelligence investigation is only to keep the president informed. That's why you hold one. Then Obama had to know. Right?
Well, yeah. How is it that the only item that you could point to that anyone in defense of the former administration or the former president could point to is that last minute letter? Because how is it that all of that happened and then all of a sudden he was just then being notified? You talk about late in the game, and I mean the last, literally the last few minutes of the game. No.
Now,
that would be part of immediately, that would have to be part of, because we're talking about counterintelligence, that would have to be part of a daily briefing.
Now, to be fair, you can make the case, you might be able to make the case and say, no, they didn't tell the president because they believed the White House would have gone crazy if they would have seen the flimsy evidence, if anybody in the White House would have said, okay, we want to see what you actually have here. You know, what do you have? Well, where'd this dossier come from? Well, did you tell the president? And if you told the president, here's the other point. If you did tell the president in October before you got the first FISA warrant, did you lie to him about the legitimacy of the evidence to support it? Did they lie to Obama on it?
Or did they never mention it, which would be lying by omission? I mean, the warrant was granted, and that's all.
Well, you might have somebody in the White House say, you know, one of the president's advisors say, wait a minute, whoa, you're getting a secret warrant 2 weeks before the election,
yeah,
on the opposition candidate
based on
here,
what?
And this is my administration. And somebody in the White House might have asked, did you cross your T's and dot your I's? What evidence do you have? Maybe they didn't want it to go that far. You can look at it both ways, but if that was a case that they didn't go to the president, then that would help prove to a jury that you all had a conspiracy to defeat this president and not do it legally.
Right.
Because you didn't want to go to Obama and tell him about it until later on. So, again.
And the letter, if you look at the Susan Rice letter, that was not giving, from that perspective, not giving the president plausible deniability, but giving themselves cover and saying, well, we did finally inform you. We did finally go to the president, the outgoing president, and informed him. It doesn't really hold water one way or the other.
No,
because
because
at that point, you get into January, you were pretty far into this investigation.
Oh, yeah.
Way too far for this not to be a part of the daily briefing if it was indeed legitimate.
Look, as far as I'm concerned, what is the protocol for something like this? Because when was the last FISA warrant that was done on a campaign,
right,
on a campaign worker? Because you were trying to sell that you believed. Look, you went to get a secret warrant. So apparently, either you believe that the president, you believed as a prosecutor, as a law enforcement officer, that this person, You had enough to get a secret warrant because you believed they were colluding with the Russians to steal the election, or you were trying to set them up.
Right.
By that point. But if it was legit, you're telling me as FBI director, you're not going to brief the president and say, look, here's where we are right now, and here's the evidence, we're laying it out, and we believe that Trump colluded with the Kremlin to steal the election. That's where we're going on this. Or did they not do it because they figured they just keep the president out of it because their whole point was, look, we probably can't stop what's going to happen in the election, but maybe we can destroy it after. What it does do is, if they didn't tell the president, to me, it even increases, if they didn't tell Obama, it even increases the possibility of proving a conspiracy of those inside the FBI the Department of Justice and any intelligence community personnel that was involved in everything from the Papadopoulos Joseph Masoud saga all the way down to the dossier. So either way, it doesn't matter either way. If Obama knew, it's bad. If he didn't know, it's really bad on someone inside there, because it does help to lead you. Well, why wouldn't you tell the president? Because your goal was not, you truly didn't believe that you had something on the president. You were just trying to set him up. And you knew that somebody in the White House, some of the legal counsel of the White House might have looked at this and said, you can't get a FISA warrant on this. You're lying.
Right.
This isn't evidence where you can do it. This is a scandal that will come back on this president, and we're walking out the door in a couple of months.
Right.
And this isn't worth it for Hillary.
And it would also stand to reason that those individuals in the outgoing really didn't care about an outgoing president. They're not looking really to protect his legacy as much as they are to protect the election and help her win and or delegitimize the win of a Donald Trump. Right?
Right.
His legacy, right. Obama's legacy, really wasn't the point. So any of the actors, would-be actors in that case at high levels of, you know, in high positions, high levels of authority, weren't worried about his legacy.
So you can make a case either way, but either way is extremely bad.
Yes. It doesn't. It's horrible. It's horrible either all the way up to the top, or it's horrible all the way up almost to the top. And I don't know if this, depending on what we learn from William Barr, but I suspect we're going to learn a lot more. I don't know how it doesn't affect Biden.
That's one of the things I wonder if there's rumblings of that in D.C. Does this, if it's bad, does it taint Biden? Doesn't affect Kamala Harris, doesn't affect Elizabeth Warren, no. Doesn't affect Bernie Sanders. It can, depending on how big this scandal is.
Yeah, I don't know how it doesn't affect him. I don't know how it doesn't.
Well, let's put it this way. If what's there is what we think is there, of course Trump's going to use it. Doesn't matter whether the media uses it, Trump's going to pound on it.
Right. Who wouldn't? If he doesn't, everybody else will for him. But of course he will.
You never know, though. He might want to stick to the Greenland thing.
Yeah, why not?
You know.
Only if you can get it at a good price. Yeah, I think it does. I think it does affect Biden, and then the question is to what extent.
866-90-RED-EYE.
Get in touch with Red Eye Radio, toll free at 866-90-RED-EYE.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Carley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. As far as I know, the timetable is still expected to be September for the Inspector General's report, right?
Yes. Yes, it is. That has not changed. Of course, it could, but assuming that's the case, so Capitol Hill comes back from the August break, Congress comes back, then you have the IG report come down. Then at some point, I'm guessing Horowitz will testify. And then, I guess, then what? William Barr will take that report and decide what is actionable within that report.
And you still have, you've got that. You've got the Connecticut Huber. You've got his. You have, and you have the Senate investigation of both what happened there and the Hillary emails.
Right.
So people forget about that. The Senate's still investigating the whole Hillary email debacle.
Yep. And I don't know, again, where that ends up, because that's not even the William Barr investigation with the federal prosecutor involved. None of these even touch on that, although a number of, I guess, common items will be found. I mean, it's all part of it. I mean, I get back to the question about the IG report. Will that include the Hillary email investigation, how that was handled? Because there was that transition, and there were common investigators, including Strzok, that were part of both. You go from the Hillary email investigation into the Russian collusion thing, and you have people who clearly now politically had common interest and had a hand in both of those situations.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One. Now, it's Red Eye Radio. Gary McNamara and Eric Harley talk about everything from politics to social issues and news of the day. Whether you're up late or just starting your day, welcome to the show. From the Pilot Flying J Studios, this is Red Eye Radio.
All across America, 866-90-RED EYE. He is Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara. Get our app. You can listen 24/7. Why don't you? Well, in the news today, the president yesterday talking about how to stimulate the economy.
We're always looking at the capital gains tax, payroll tax. We're looking at, I would love to do something on capital gains. We're talking about that. That's a big deal, goes through Congress.
Interesting where he talked about capital gains going through Congress, because earlier in the day they were talking about the fact they were going to try to see if they could do something where he could put through an executive order, and that would be, for example, should they tie it into the inflation rate or not. Democrats screamed and said, no, if you do that, we'll take you to federal court and stop you from doing that. And so it was interesting that by the time we got to the afternoon, the president was saying that the capital gains, you would need Congress's approval to change that. Also, the president, yes, talking about a payroll tax, and it gets confusing because Sunday the Washington Post had the story stating that they were in discussions about a payroll tax. Nothing had been, decision had been made on it, but they had been discussing a payroll tax. On Monday, the president's aides came out and said, absolutely not. We are not talking about a payroll tax, and the president comes out and on the next day and says we're talking about a payroll tax. So, look, Eric, you were coming up with some unique scenarios that the only way you would see some type of payroll tax is if the middle class got a payroll tax cut somehow, however it would be, but the corporations and the rich would have to make up for it. And that is something that the Democrats would go for. But if the president is trying to do a payroll tax just to stimulate the economy, that the left is going to have to get the left is going to have to get some penance from the president, for helping to spur the economy. And that would be, we get taxes, or you even stated and I don't think this would go through. But I don't think the president would go for it, that they would just go back to, we'll give you this temporary reduction in the payroll tax, but you've got to raise corporate taxes back to 26-27%.
Yeah. Well, because they're going to want something on their end. They're going to want something in exchange. They're not going to just go along with the president's plan and not look for something else that on a permanent level. So they, but if there's any hope of something like that happening, the only thing I think the Democrats would be on board for, and again, I don't think it's going to happen, but it would be something like an exemption or a temporary hiatus in that tax for people or households earning below whatever, $75,000 a year. And that the companies would have to, large companies would have to increase during that same period their contribution, which doesn't make, none of it actually makes any sense, because if you think about what it's designed to do, what the payroll tax is, why would you want to stop payment into a system right now that's already hurting and underfunded? In terms of the mandates ahead of us, that's the last thing you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that you give a break to people, and they don't have to pay it for whatever it is, 90 days, 6 months, a year. And we'll see if that is actually even floated.
And the president was also on, talking about, cutting the base interest rate 1 percentage point, which would be from 2.25% to 1.25%, and other measures that you would only do. And we stated this yesterday. We said the administration is trying to have it both ways. They're trying to say there's no chance of a recession. Anybody who's talking recession is throwing fake news at you, at the same time promoting a policy that you would only put in effect if you were scared that you were heading into a pretty big recession. We have not stated whether, we have not stated we're going into a recession. We don't know. We doubt that we are right now. But it's the perception of saying one thing and then proposing something that you would only do if you believed you were going into some severe economic times. The other thing is the story that came out from Politico that at a fundraising luncheon this week in Jackson, Wyoming, headlined by both Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney acknowledged the risks to the GOP elite behind closed doors. If the U.S. were to face a recession, it would be moderate and short, Mulvaney told the roughly 50 donors, according to the attendees. It's interesting because we've said the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. We said the exact same thing. If we were going into a recession, it would be short. We believe, and that's based on the fact of looking at the last two recessions that we've been in that were both caused by bubbles, one the dot-com bubble and the other that we felt for a significant period of time, which was the housing bubble. We may have a housing bubble brewing, but we're not in a housing bubble right now. That's not going to hit here at this moment. What you really have, if we do go into a recession, hypothetically, if we went into a recession, what's hurting us is manufacturing output.
Mm-hmm.
Manufacturing output, and if that it was basically flat, just a little bit over flat, but basically flat, and the lowest level since 2009, and the service sector, the index for the service sector was a 3-year low. Now, consumer spending is really good, but if consumer spending goes down, which is why I think the administration is trying to keep up spirits and talking about the fact of giving a tax cut. But here's the point. If you're and again, who knows who's listening to what and how it affects the population out there. But if you're out there stating that we have no chance of a recession, but at the same time promoting the fact of policies that you would only enact if you believe we had severe economic times, how does the public respond to that? And I don't know. That would be the
yeah.
How does the public respond to that mixed message? Because
mm-hmm.
clearly it's a mixed message. And so you ask, and it gets frustrating. We say, why are you doing it? And that yesterday, on top of the president now canceling the meeting with the prime minister of Denmark based on the fact that she said, no, Greenland isn't for sale, when that wasn't on the itinerary for discussion anyway with the prime minister of Denmark until it came up this week, just adds to a certain bizarreness in pop culture. And we've talked about this before. Sometimes the worst damage to a president can be not in the substance of the politics or the issues that you're promoting, but the pop culture bizarreness of something that you do.
Sure.
And the Greenland thing was just all over the news. Everybody knows about the Greenland thing. Number one, it's easy to understand. The president wants to buy Greenland. The jokes start from that point.
Right.
As they did. And sometimes something that isn't even taken as serious. And here's the point. nobody was taking this serious, not even the White House. It became serious when you cancel a meeting with the prime minister and say that's the reason you do it.
Yes.
So it, you take something right. that was a joke and you make it serious for what reason?
There's no political gain for that.
No.
None.
There's no political gain. And we've stated this before. I want this president to win because the only other choice is pure insanity. Absolute pure insanity. We believe that the messaging has been horrible. We believe it can be a lot better. We don't think it's hard to do. A little self-discipline is what it takes.
It's about it.
It's about it. It's not hard. And it just keeps piling up every day. Every day there's another little one, 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 to the point where you're not even hearing the defense anymore. Well, this is 98th dimension chess. We keep going up on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or you have to understand this is a genius move by the president. You're not hearing that defense as much anymore.
No.
And that gets to be a problem where there should be no problem. On all these issues here, you can just, we've said this, you can just destroy the left on everything. And yet we're talking about Greenland. Why? Why?
Yeah, I think the focus is very clear, has to be very clear, and it's on two fronts. What the left is saying, what the left is doing, and your accomplishments.
No, I think you had the best campaign strategy for this campaign.
Point.
And one word, point.
Point.
Look at what they're doing. 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 Look at what, you never have to talk about yourself. You never have to be on the defensive ever. You don't have to bring up anything that doesn't have to do with pointing at the absurdity of everything that they're doing across the board.
Right. Well, and I think that's, again, I could see, here's what I'd love to see. The president at a campaign rally playing videos, a montage of everything that the left is saying and doing. And then a video montage of all of the accomplishments with the economy. And where the president's not saying a word, all he's doing is smiling. Can you imagine?
Well, you mean like the videos that are on Facebook all the time?
Yeah, essentially.
No, those are fantastic.
And it would be a live version of that.
Right. Well, it's the ones on immigration.
Yes.
The ones on immigration with Obama talking, and Obama sounds like Trump on immigration. And then they flash right to Trump looking like, well, see, he gets it. Everyone, isn't every picture of Trump? Well, he gets it. The president doesn't even talk in those. He just gestures like, smiles like, oh. Finally, they see what I've been talking about. Oh, they agree with me. Wow, that would be a novel thing to take something like that, which is actually used as comedy, but makes the point so incredibly strong. You could use, Trump could use that. He is the one candidate that could use something like that, and it would be massively effective, would it not?
And I think he wouldn't even have to say anything.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what you see on the social media
just
videos.
Just look and just smile looks. At the audience. The stand on your feet cheers for him would go on for a long, long time. Because it really is, that's what you're looking at. That really is your choice. You can choose to go with the left and everything that they're promoting and all the craziness. Or you can choose to stay with this president and the things he's accomplished. Look, we can have the debates on the tariff thing and especially China and everything going on there. But I think most people right now look at China and say, okay, we're in a situation where you don't want to back down now. I don't know what's going to be done, but you really don't want to back down now. So that really, I think, is a non-starter at the rally. It still has its place, but I don't know that it really has an effect one way or the other until we know more about what China's going to do or not do. The fact of the matter is, you put on display in that setting that kind of difference, that juxtaposition, mm-hmm. and it becomes very, very clear. I think very effective.
But you don't think we should bomb Greenland?
No. Then, well, if we did...
Bomb what?
Well, that's a good point. I don't know if there's... I mean, it's not even a flyover place because it's just a blip.
Leave the golf course alone.
But it would be cheaper afterward, though. A lot cheaper. You want to sell it now? No. No, no. Just joking. We're not bombing Greenland.
Sell as is.
Water balloons. We'll drop water balloons.
866-90-RED-EYE.
It's no surprise computer usage on farms is up compared to 2 years ago.
In fact, in 2019, 73% of the U.S. farms have a desktop or laptop computer of which they use to access. That's an increase of roughly 1% from 2017.
And also no surprise, according to Jody McDaniel of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, is the rise in use of mobile devices on farms.
One of the most notable increases was in farms using a smartphone or tablet to conduct farm business. 52%, now up from 44% in 2017.
The every other year survey conducted by NAS also reveals 3/4 of all U.S. farms have internet access, up 2% from 2 years ago, with increases in both fiber optic and satellite service. Although,
in 2019, 26% of U.S. farms accessed the internet via satellite, DSL, was the second most common method at 22% for all farms.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The USDA report is brought to you by Cenex Roadmaster XL Premium Highway Diesel Fuel.
Coming up, more with Gary McNamara and Eric Harley. It's Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Harley, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. We'll get to that AOC story. She called for the Electoral College. She called the Electoral College a scam. They're going to be on it. Look, we're not. The Electoral College isn't going anywhere.
No.
It's definitely not going anywhere before 2020.
No, definitely not.
So they're going to be screaming and yelling about it, but we'll get to the lack of substance of her argument. Coming up here in just a little bit. By the way, we should make note with something we haven't talked about, because when we had talked about the tariffs and the steel and aluminum tariffs, and said, look, what's going to one of the things you're always concerned with when you put tariffs on is, yeah, the steel companies might make more profits on what they're selling, but demand will decrease. Well, you saw U.S. Steel last month shut down a blast furnace and now has laid off 200 workers.
Right.
And why? The laws of economics. You can change an economy, but you can't change how people respond to incentive and disincentive. We've said that 1,000 times. So,
yeah, and it's, again, you're not going to, with everything going on with China, you're not going to change the dynamics there. I guess the question is, how long can that hold before you see a number of farming communities start to just collapse?
Here's the thing that we don't know, and maybe the CIA does. We don't know, but we don't know the internal workings of what the pressures are inside the Communist Party in China right now. Those are some of the things we don't know. The CIA may know that and inform the president of what's going on. We don't know. So that's one of the problems we're at loss to know. Now, we know they're being hurt economically, mm-hmm. and in all likelihood, probably more than we are.
Sure.
Here's your national forecast.
Mother Nature's been like a faucet for areas of the Gulf Coast and portions of western Florida over the past week or so. But we are going to start to see a pattern change in the upper-level steering winds. Instead of air and moisture being drawn up as part of a ridge, we'll see some slight troughing where air will actually push that system back into the Gulf. That's at least the way things look on some of the forecast models. 5 to 7 day rainfall forecast totals now are showing the greatest amount of precip right in the Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, and Missouri corridor. Now, we will continue to see that high summer heat and humidity in several sections of the country, including the desert Southwest, the South Central Plains, mid to lower Mississippi Valley, and a small part of the Mid-Atlantic. Look for near triple-digit heat for Dallas the rest of the week. Today in New York City, the high with a chance of rain, 91. The national forecast from Red Eye Radio, I'm meteorologist John Trout.
Red Eye Radio.
And he's Eric Carley. I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. So, AOC took aim at the Electoral College, calling it a scam and suggesting it disenfranchises people of color. In an Instagram story posted on Monday, AOC began by joking that she saw many votes while driving through the desert, which she sarcastically referred to as the Electoral College. She then cited several excerpts from a New York Magazine article that refutes arguments in favor of the Electoral College, telling Republicans that the system is, in fact, a scam. The Electoral College has a racial injustice breakdown, Ocasio-Cortez says, due to severe racial disparities in certain states. The Electoral College effectively weighs white voters over voters of color, as opposed to one person, one vote system, where all of our votes are counted equally. The AOC went on to blast the argument that the Electoral College would give rural states a fair shake. Could you imagine if we had this kind of democracy-altering fairness provision for literally any other group? The congressman asked, if we weighed, for example, blacks and indigenous voters more because of unfairness. She later pointed to Republicans who live in blue states and how their votes count equally in a popular vote, and said that eliminating the Electoral College would end the special treatment of some voters over others. Except for one thing she's forgetting. What's the biggest percentage in a state of population of blacks? Mississippi. Those blacks would be disenfranchised under a popular vote completely. What they think wouldn't matter.
Sure.
Who would control the elections in this country would be California, Texas, Florida, New York.
And everything else would be a desert.
Yeah, everything else would. But it's not understanding, again, what she's trying to equate geographical areas with individuals. And as we know, here's the point. The person who believes in freedom understands the Electoral College, and let me explain. This country was not set up for the federal government to be the major power and controller of every little stinking aspect of your life. Mm. If that was going to happen, now we believe that no government is supposed to do that, but on the vast majority of issues, it was the states and the local government that was supposed to be in charge. The federal government was never deemed that they were going to have the power and control over your life and the tax power over your life that they have today. And so when it was a country that even those that believed in a bigger central government would never imagine the central government that we have today. Right. And the aspects and the money that they suck out of the individual from every certain geographical area. The socialist wants a direct vote. Why? Because they know then that the huge states with the large urban areas that are much more socialistic will control the entire country.
Yeah, sure.
Now, if the Electoral College is wrong, then the Senate is wrong.
Yes.
Which the left is moving towards, that the Senate is also wrong, which means geographical areas mean nothing anymore. Geographical areas and what they have in their geographical area really help to set the mindset of a particular state and can help determine what industries they have by what rivers they have, what natural resources they have. Think about this. Can states control any of their natural resources, or anything that the state controls of state land, if everything is run by a direct vote? And the federal government has the primary responsibility to take care of everybody. Does that state have any control over their geographical area? They do not. The whole concept of this country was formed on the fact that you should be governed most. The people that should be governing you most and affecting your life the most should be the people closest to you. The people that live down the road. The people that you can see at a town hall meeting. The people that have to be, because of the closeness of a community, they are the ones that you can directly go to. Your board of education, your local town council, because your garbage isn't being picked up, your local town or city council, because you've got sewer problems, water problems. They're the ones that take care of that. And you are much more likely to have a response from a government that is close to you. If you live in a geographical area or a state that has a low population, and you have a federal government that is, everyone is determined, the vote is determined by who has the greatest population, then you lose any autonomy or control, self-control of your local area that you live in. That's the problem. Founding fathers understand it. We understand it. It's the fact that control and authority for government to be able to perform certain actions should be closer to the people, because then you are much more likely to get a direct response. The people can have a government that will respond to them. There's no reason for any government to respond to a Rhode Island for any issue if there's no Electoral College or Senate. There's no reason to. You have no chance of getting the federal government to respond to you if everything is run from the big population centers.
Well, you talk about disenfranchised.
Oh, you see, unbelievably disenfranchised.
It's at that point, it's over until you decide to what? Relocate to California or in one of the larger states.
Well, it's one of the reasons they did this was, number one, the initial states wanted to get in, but it was the only way to get them in, because they wanted representation. But also, if you wish to prevent a civil war, what's the easiest way to get a civil war? A people of a certain geographical area have no say or control over their own lives or their own destiny, because somebody else from a far off land controls what they do. You know, we talk about globalization. We talk about the European Union and the British that are upset because they ceded control, a lot of local control and things that affect them and affect their pocketbook, to the European Union.
Hmm.
And so their their ability to protest it because now they're in a huge European Union has just been cut tremendously, where their influence to control what happens in their own country has disappeared. You want to have a revolution? That's how you create a revolution. That's what you're seeing in Brexit right now. You want a revolution in the United States? Make it so half the country has no say. No say over local rules and regulations that have now become federal.
Right.
Because the federal government keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Think about this now. The left wants the federal government to control your health care completely. Well, that's crazy.
Well, and it is control of everything, though. It's control of, yes. And it started, you think about the Department of Education. More and more control over the decisions made in your school district.
We'll give you a perfect example. When local states and communities find, as we remember in Louisiana, the state of Louisiana found that that blacks, when it came to grades, and when it came to schooling, weren't performing as well. So what they did was, they came up with the voucher program to give minorities the choice of schools to go to. They were in control and said, this is what we wish to do as a state. We wish to give people more choice. And we want to give people choice that don't have a choice. So the people that are poor in this state will get this choice. And it just happens to be that the majority in that state were black.
Right.
That were more poor. So we as a state are deciding to give them a choice of education so they don't have to be in a system that they view as unequal when it comes to education in other land or in other areas of the particular state. So we as a state have decided to do this. What happened with Obama? Obama came in. I can't think of the attorney general's name.
Eric Holder.
Eric Holder came in and said, "You people have to. We're filing suit against you, so we're going to stop it." The program, tremendous support and success from minorities. The federal government came in and said, "You as a state, even though it's your state money, can't do it." They had to back off. The federal government had to back off. What did the federal government try to do because they have control of D.C.? What did Obama try to do every single year? He tried to kill the voucher program, which was extremely popular with minorities in D.C. Why is the federal government involved in this? Why can't the local community run it on their own?
Well, and I mean, if you look at it, really, it is the nationalization of everything.
Exactly. So when you want to nationalize and socialize everything, of course, you want to set up a system where that is, wow, we've got slam dunk because the majority of the population is in the big cities. A significant portion of the population are in these big cities and these big states. The majority of them are more liberal, more socialist. We can control the entire country. We can set the doctrine. We can get exactly what we want. We can control your life. We can federalize and nationalize everything where you have no self-determination where you live. You want to start a revolution? That's what starts a revolution.
There you get it. That's it.
Founding fathers understand it. We understand it. You understand it. It's about ensuring that the tyranny of the majority does not oppress the minority. That's the entire concept. Very weak argument from AOC.
Well, I mean, and think about doing away with, if you do away with the Electoral College and you do away with then the possibility of how many people running in the race. How many people just running openly in the race, and what would the results be?
Oh, yeah.
And you have somebody with a and while he won, neither Hillary or Trump got over 50% of the vote, you still had a large plurality of the popular vote won, and that was, and because they keep saying she won the majority. Well, no, she didn't win the majority. She won a plurality because she didn't get over 50%.
Right.
However, imagine that you start getting how many different candidates jumping in.
Right, and a candidate wins 17% and becomes a president of the United States.
Right.
Most people don't feel that they're represented at that point.
Right.
And that's the whole point of having the Electoral College, of having the Senate. People believe, and this is, again, this shows the ignorance of anybody who doesn't understand what makes a society work.
Mm-hmm.
Representation. The belief that somebody cares about you, even if you don't get the response you want all the time, you still believe somebody represents you.
Right.
866-90-RED-EYE.
What's the difference between standard number 2 diesel and premium fuel? Ron Jessen is director of product management for Cenex, the makers of Cenex Roadmaster XL premium diesel fuel, and he fills us in.
You may want to consider the total operational cost behind the price of the pump. If you look at the cost for replacement and you look at the cost of ongoing maintenance, unfortunately, those costs haven't gone down. They've actually continued to increase. But switching to a premium diesel fuel can really result in some large operational savings with the fuel economy and reducing the equipment repair costs. Our fleet owners, if you want to consider trying a premium diesel fuel in the past, or if you have considered it in the past, now is really the time to take advantage of that with the lower diesel fuel prices to try out that premium diesel fuel.
There are more than 1,450 Cenex locations in 19 states across the Midwest and Pacific Northwest. Visit Cenex.com to find a Cenex location and learn more. This report is a service of Shell Rotella.
Lines open for your calls. 866-90-RED-EYE on Red Eye Radio.
It's Red Eye Radio. He is Eric Carney, and I'm Gary McNamara, 866-90-RED-EYE. It will be interesting to see where the president goes with any type of tax cuts, because how will he get the Democrats aboard? Because just like last time, anything he does now, just like the budget, will have to be a deal he makes with the Democrats in the House.
Yeah, and I don't see them making a deal. I don't see any kind of tax deal being worked out with the Democrats before Election Day next year.
This is Red Eye Radio on Westwood One.